I finally got like confident enough to step inside the front door, and then had this really kind of huge feeling that I'd missed out already on everything.
Hello, my name's Gay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So, I'm starting off this week's episode with a bit of a weird question, and that question is, do you ever get nostalgic for a time or a place that you weren't even there to experience in the first place? Well, that's kind of what happened to this week's guest, illustrator and cartoonist Eric Kostiak-Williams. So he had first moved to Toronto in 2008, and it took him a few years to really kind of figure out where his particular corner of the scene was. And it turned out that it was in the art fag scene. Those are his words, not mine. And by the time he got there, just as he figured out this is where he wanted to be, he could feel that the scene was shifting and moving on, meaning that he always had this feeling that he just missed out on those really magical, the most magical nights that happened at his Lost Space, the Beaver. But that's not to say that he still didn't get to have a good time. Let's not get it twisted. That very much was his MO. We caught up to talk about his new book, 2AM Eternal, which is a bit of a love letter, really, to the nightlife of Toronto over the last 10 years. And it documents all of the party flyers and promos that he had a hand in illustrating. And along the way, we talk about when and how best to leave a party, what our evolving relationship with the word queer is, and how to let go of your twinkdom. What happens when you're no longer a twink? Okay, let's get into it. In your book, you described yourself when you first got to Toronto as a new twink on the block.
Yes.
And I'm kind of fascinated by the word twink. So I want to just unpack your understanding. Oh, sorry, I'm over-intellectualizing the word twink.
Oh, no, bring it.
Okay, cool. So I always thought that the word twink was kind of derogatory.
It was when I was younger, for sure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that was the question. So when you were a twink, wait, first of all, do you still identify as a twink?
Well, I think I'm going through the change currently, where I think I have like 1 foot out the door from twinkdom. I believe they call it a twunk afterwards, but I find twinkdom kind of fascinating. I think people project a lot onto it, like onto twinks. When I was a twink in like the late 2000s, it felt very derogatory. Like it's a term I really resented. And if I ever heard it spoken about me, it was not in a positive way. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of like disdain, but also sometimes a sense of like envy of youth or something. Yeah. Like it's a lot of things all kind of wrapped up in one, and continues to be, I think. Yeah.
But and so when you were, I mean, you're still half claiming twinkency.
Yeah.
But when you were like younger and people would call you a twink, would you rally against that? Or would you be like, yeah, okay, I am a twink?
I'd be kind of resigned to it because I would look up and down and be like, well, I can't argue that. But I'm more than that. Oh, but the thing that really hits the nail on the head with it is that my iPhone, it like automatically recognizes faces and groups them into little folders, and it literally has two groups for me. It has like twink me and 30s me as two different people.
Oh. But is that because of the mustache or?
The mustache is, yeah, because I got my mustache a few years ago. I think that's part of it. But I mean, I think my face is also just like filled in and changed as I've gone into my 30s. Like, so, I look different. It's funny.
So you can trace it back to the exact moment you stopped being a twink.
I think I started drifting out of twinkdom in lockdown, actually.
Oh, COVID-19. So much to answer for.
A lot of trans people I know transitioned during lockdown because they just had those months away from everyone to be like, okay, I'm going to get on my hormones and do my thing. Whereas for me, I was more passive about it. I just let twinkdom start escaping during lockdown months.
But to be clear, right now you're comparing your move away from twinkocracy to someone transitioning.
I wouldn't equate them, but I'm transitioning out of twinkdom, I would say. years ago, one of my friends who's trans mask stayed at my house from New York, and he uses testosterone gel, mm-hmm. and he crashed with me for a couple weeks and then left, and he left behind one of his testosterone gel packets, and I texted him after being like, oh no, you forgot this. And then he was like, oh no, that's for you, babe. Because we joked that he probably has more testosterone in his body than I do.
And did you use it?
I haven't. I like to keep it in my washroom as an artifact, like a little objet.
Doesn't it go off, though?
I would have to check the expiry date, yeah. But I like leaving it in my washroom as just like something for anyone who comes over to see and be like, huh, I wonder why that's there, you know?
So paint me a picture of Twinkie Eric in 2008.
Well, I moved to Toronto from Ottawa, where I grew up in 2008. I'd visited Toronto as a teenager to go to comic book conventions. Aww. In retrospect, I look back on comic conventions as like another form of pride weekend where like a subculture gets to rise up for a few days.
But with better costumes.
And we would often stay at a hotel downtown close to the gay village in Toronto. And I like wasn't out yet, but something about being close to the gay neighborhood in Toronto and like just observing everyone, I was like, something about this city, like, I think I have to move here someday. Can't exactly articulate why, but I just feel like I should end up here probably.
And so you weren't out then, but were you out to yourself?
Yes. I hooked up with my best friend throughout all of high school, who is also a big X-Men fan.
As you do, yeah.
But I thought we were very clever and like sneaky about it, but then years later realized that everyone knew and like wasn't that surprised or concerned about it.
Oh. So when you came out, people were like, yeah.
Yeah, like one of my family members when I came out just paused and then looked at me and said, was that so hard? So it's been pretty clear from birth, basically. Oh.
But okay, wait. I need to ask questions about you sleeping with your friend. Mm. And there's lots of me projecting within this question and this line of questioning, so apologies. Why did he only remain a friend?
Oh, that was probably I think I wasn't really ready at that age to like have a boyfriend and like have that as an identity.
But isn't that all you want at that age?
Not yet. I mean, I wanted that like into university and into my early 20s. But in high school, I just wanted to like not be noticed. Like I just wanted, because I'd been bullied so badly before that, that in high school, I was just like listening to Radiohead and wearing neutral colors. And like, I was just like, look over there. Yeah, we're still friends, actually. I'm really happy we've kept in touch. He's like, I kind of owe it all to him because we'd become close in our first year of high school. And he very bravely, at the end of our first year of high school, just asked me when we were hanging out one night if I wanted to hook up.
Like, how did it go?
It was weird, but great. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, it was good. I think we were actually watching the first X-Men movie in his basement the first time we hooked up. So this is all very, it's all very interwoven.
Yeah. Oh, how exciting. Okay. So you were saying that there was something in the air when you were in Toronto that made you think, this is a place that I need to be.
Yeah, yeah. And broadly, there was something in the air in Toronto in the 2000s. It was having a really good moment. Yeah, like, I don't know, everyone was wearing really bright colors. The city was expensive, but not expensive in the way it is now. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of really thriving creative communities and like queer communities in the city. And like pop music was really fun at that point in the 2000s as well. Like it was, I think the pop stars were all realizing that gay people had money to spend and could be a meaningful support base.
Oh yeah. I love when music is created for a cynical cash grab. That's the best kind of music.
Worked for me at the time, worked on me. No.
Okay. So first days in Toronto, what do you remember most? Like, who were you?
Well, I think it was a moment in my life that I've never had before or since where I didn't know anybody when I moved to Toronto. Mm-hmm. All of my high school friends went to Montreal or Halifax. So I had this opportunity to be like, who do I want to be? Like, who am I in this city? So I really just like queened out hard and like bought skinny jeans in every color imaginable. And it was really inspiring. Like there were these great used CD and bookstores in my university neighborhood. So I was just like reading like queer theory and history, listening to a lot of electronic music because I was finding CDs for like $4. Mm. So it was a really cool time. Also like messy. And I mean, a lot of those nights weren't always the most fun if I actually like put myself in my shoes back then. But the overall experience was like worthwhile.
Oh, why not fun? Just because of the melodrama of youth or?
Well, I think what came with all this learning a lot of stuff and figuring myself out, there was a lot of insecurity that went with that. Just being so kind of like fresh and new to things. And I think I was one of the last gay cohort who had to learn how to like cruise at a bar. Because like the hookup apps had started up, but they weren't really a normal thing like they are now.
Are you saying this like it's a bad thing, a good thing, or a neutral thing?
Kind of neutral, I guess. Okay. Yeah, I prefer cruising in person to cruising on the apps. But yeah, I would often have to go through the ropes like in person of like trying to pick someone up, feeling rejected because of the whole like twink thing.
What, you got rejected because you were a twink?
Sometimes.
Is that why you have a mustache now?
I can neither confirm or deny. No. But I think if I'd sold myself more confidently, I could have pulled some more people, you know.
Yeah, I always tried to like fool myself that my shyness was a good selling point, but I don't think it was. I think I just needed to be more forthright.
Mm-hmm. I've never regretted being more forthright, you know.
Never?
I don't know. Like if it led to something that didn't work out, I knew sooner, you know. Like,
oh, okay. And the shame goes away, right?
Yeah. But yeah, shyness has its points. Like it gives you a mystique or something. Mm. But I just think back on like so many like friendships, lovers, etc. that I've probably missed out on just by being kind of aloof or like having a force field around me, you know?
Yeah, my force field is like double strength. But I feel like there are these people who are that kind of shy aloofness and it works in their favor. And I don't understand how. Because my shyness and my aloofness, people are just like, okay, I won't bother, bye.
I know what you mean. Like I know of some people where they have a very kind of like slinky kitty cat vibe where you're just like, ooh, I'm going to follow that cat and see.
Maybe it's just because they're better looking than me.
I don't know about that. I think like I was saying before, it's all about kind of how you're carrying yourself, you know?
Well, so how should you carry yourself if you're shy?
I don't know. Maybe like be shy, but try to have like a more inviting resting face.
Oh.
That might be part of it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm being red here, aren't I?
Ah.
Resting bitch face strikes again.
Oh, I'm known for it too. It's fine.
But there is also like sometimes when being forthright can push people into a corner.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I've been in that corner on the receiving end of that before. I'm just like, ah.
Too much too soon. Yeah. So like with most things in life, there's no one answer.
No, I don't think so. That would be too easy.
Yeah, I'd quite like easy, to be honest.
Sometimes, yeah, that'd be nice. But yeah, like I've found that friends of mine who've moved to Toronto after have said that it took them a few years to find the places they like to go and the people they like to hang out with. And I think that was kind of the case for me as well. Like I was happy to land where I did in the church in Wellesley, like Gay Village. But yeah, I think it took me 3 or 4 years to find the places I liked to go where the way I carried myself was a bit more in line with what everyone else is doing. I don't know, like where I found my people.
And so where did you find your people?
I think it started from getting my first real job working at this vegan restaurant downtown, which has now become this like empire. But at the time it was one of the only big vegan places in Toronto. There's a lot that I didn't like about that place, but the managers hired only queer people.
Surely that's against the law.
I know, it's its own form of like reverse discriminatory hiring practice.
Well, we won't mention the name of the restaurant. Okay, go.
No. But it was really like circa like 2010. This was really kind of the distinction at the time between like gay and queer, where when I started working at this restaurant, I was working with like lots of trans people, lots of gender non-conforming people, like lesbians, a couple gay guys. Everyone who worked there was like a musician or an actor. So I was told years after I started there that I was hired because I wore eyeliner to the interview. And the boss, who became a friend later, she was like, oh my god, yeah, you came into the interview, had no experience, were kind of useless, but we were like, we need to hire this little queer kid and protect him.
Aww.
They really, yeah, everyone who worked there was like 5 to 10 years older than me, and they really kind of showed me the ropes and informed my like personal ideologies, and like they started taking me out dancing with them to smaller queer bars outside the village, deeper into Toronto's West End. And these were all bars that started up probably a few years before I moved to the city, often by younger people, and sometimes the bars were like the size of a living room. But like my first aha moment was being like, oh, Toronto, lots of gay people want to live there. But then the second aha moment was, oh, within this big gay city, there is a very particular community that feels really unique and really inspiring.
Yeah, it's fascinating how that happens, isn't it? Like when you are a kid and you think, oh, I'm just going to escape to the city and I'm going to go on the gay scene and all the gay people are going to love me. And then you get there and you're like, oh, this is a bit...
Like, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, like,
this is a bit weird. And like, I'm stuttering over all my conversations with people because I don't have any natural rapport with them. And they're all hairless and buff and they've got really big nipples and I don't really understand this. And then you find like these other little crevices and little pockets of scenes and you're like, yes, this fits much better.
Yes. Yeah. The community I fell into was full of people who probably felt the same way as me and wanted to make something new happen and realized that they had to do it themselves.
And so I know that I keep taking us off on different little cul-de-sacs, so apologies, but I want to pick up on something that you said about the intersection between gay and queer, or maybe those weren't the words you used, but something along those lines, and how the emergence of queer from the gay ashes, those are definitely not the words you used, but was happening around that time. What's your relationship with the word queer?
Oh my God, that's so... hard. It's changed so much over the years. I think around 2010, when I was first getting into more of a queer identified community, I identified really strongly with it. When I was younger, I found the gay label a bit stifling and a bit homogenous in what I observed around me at the time. And then I feel like as the years went by, queer kind of started feeling that way too, in its own ways. Maybe like a bit too like taken up by an academic context or something. I feel like in more recent years, I've just come to rest on identifying as a faggot. So it's like kind of a circling back to gay in a way, but in a less polished, more kind of Nelly, more rotted, but also more like third eye open kind of way. And like, I feel like faggot isn't at odds with queer or gay. It's kind of like nothing and everything altogether.
But it's kind of a word that you use with a knowing wink.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like faggot, like, keeps sexuality at the forefront or something.
Where queer doesn't.
No, I feel like over the years, queer has become, like, broader and defined. There's that bell hooks quote that gets passed around every now and then online where it's, I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, queer, not as in like who you're sleeping with, but queer as in like feeling this way about the world and like being like positioned in this way. And I can understand the intention behind that. And I don't think it's like terrible or anything, but I also am just like, oh, but I am queer as in like who I fuck and like.
Yeah. But why does sexuality need to be at the forefront?
I think because that's like what we've faced discrimination for, and it's where the discrimination creeps back, sometimes even from more conservative parts of like a gay or queer community. Like, yeah, I don't know.
It's sorry, so within a gay or queer community, do you mean people who are conservative and shame you for your sexuality? And like how you practice your sexuality, not what your sexuality is.
Sure, yeah. Okay. Like, I feel like respectability politics can come in. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there's people who are so much more articulate about this stuff than I am.
Oh, yeah, but I'm not asking for their relationship with the word. I'm asking for yours. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, you want to stop talking about this? And I'm gonna...
No, it's okay. Yeah, I find it really challenging, though, to have like an elevator pitch length answer for it. I feel like it's something that's always changing a bit as time goes on. Yeah.
And the answer can also just be, it feels better in my mouth.
Yes.
Like you don't need to have worked through and figured out why you prefer one word over the other. You can just be like, yeah, I just prefer to call myself a fag.
Yeah. No, and I don't think there's ever really like an end point I think we're always kind of in a process of figuring ourselves out and kind of adapting and whatnot.
And it's faggot, not fag.
Oh, either's fine.
Either's fine. Yeah. Okay. And but do you ever say Nelly? Because I quite liked when you said that. Say it again.
I should say it more. I feel like I say it in my head, but it's not, doesn't work its way into conversation that often.
And just to be a shit stirrer, is it that you just get bored of terminology and you want to move on to the next one?
So passé. But yeah, the community like shifts over time. It's funny. You'll be doing your thing and then a few years have passed. Then you look around you and you're like, oh, like I don't actually have a lot in common with these people. It's funny. Yeah.
Is it a bit like when you love this band for years and then suddenly they get really popular and you're like, oh, I don't really like them anymore.
That can be part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So you were talking about being in Toronto. You were talking about that feeling. Oh, you were talking about the restaurant and you were talking about stumbling upon or being introduced to the scene.
Oh, yes. Being introduced to the West End bars. And those bars at the time were the Hen House, the Beaver, which I think you've talked about on this podcast before with Johnny, right?
I have talked about the Beaver with about 10 different people.
I love it. That's a testament to its influence, its stranglehold on all of us. Yeah, that's so funny.
It's fascinating. It is the bar that everyone wants to talk about. So many people. It's the most featured bar on the show.
Hilarious. So, I mean, it's so funny because it was such a small place physically, but had this kind of power where it meant, the meaning was subjective, but it meant like so much in unique ways to everyone who experienced it over the years. Yeah.
So what did it mean to you?
Well, for me, at first it was like the bar I was too shy to even step into because I was like, oh, these people are way too cool for me. Like, holy shit.
And you were peak twinkdom at this point, right?
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, like it was a very like art faggy scene. This was right towards the end of Will Monroe's life. Uh-huh. He co-opened the Beaver. And before he opened the Beaver, he had been throwing all of these parties, kind of like alternative queer events throughout downtown Toronto, and then eventually opened the Beaver as kind of a home base. And he really influenced his whole like cohort and generation of queer art people in Toronto. And that influence has carried on to this day, I would say. And he passed away in 2010 from cancer. And it was very, very trippy because that was kind of around when I first started going to the Beaver myself a bit more. So I finally got like confident enough to step inside the front door and then had this really kind of huge feeling that I'd missed out already on everything.
So when you said I was too scared to go, I thought you meant like, oh, it took me like a week to pluck up the courage. But how long are you actually talking?
Oh, I can't remember now. But I mean, I think I would often be in the area and I would go next door to the Gladstone, which had queer events too. I probably stepped in there after a few tries, but my first memories would just be of walking by and being like, oh, it's so small in there. I'm so nervous to like step inside.
Oh, because is it that thing about having the anxiety of being in a bar where there's nowhere to rest? And so you're just in everyone's way.
A little bit, yeah. And you're very on display as soon as you walk in, just because it's so small. Mm-hmm. And this is something I came to love about the parties there, but a lot of the parties would feel like a house party, but at a bar instead of in someone's apartment, you know?
Oh, yeah. I hate house parties. Because it feels like you need to be nice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And yeah, like there was the feeling like if you were new to that scene, you would walk in and be like, oh, I feel like I've crashed a house party. Mm-hmm. And like everyone knows each other already. Everyone has their own kind of secret language and history So it felt hard to break into at first. Mm-hmm. And then after Will died, thankfully the Beaver kept its doors open. I feel like a good chunk of his community stayed really active with throwing their parties. I think very deliberately, like in his memory, to keep the queer West scene alive, as it was called. But I think for a lot of the younger people like myself, there was a very strange, like bittersweet feeling of feeling like you'd missed the best years and you were starting to go out in this place that had this like layer of sadness hanging over it because all of my like party elders had like gone through this like shared grieving process. It was really wild.
Okay, so how does that look in practice then?
It was complicated. Yeah, I was so curious to hear more about the years I'd missed, and to learn more about the history. And I remember someone telling me pretty directly, being like, "Oh, like nothing like that will ever happen again. Like nothing's the same now. It'll never be like that again." And I could understand where that feeling came from, but that was hard to hear as someone who was just starting to go out and wanting to like make their own stuff happen. Mm-hmm. And it probably wasn't ever quite the same as it was in those years, but I think the years afterward proved that we were able to start our own thing, which I'm so happy for. Yeah.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? Like, obviously, I'm not part of the Toronto scene. I'm not trying to, like, shit on Will's legacy or anything in what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But I feel like every generation is a bit like that with, like, oh, it's never going to be the same again. Like, even the conversation that we had earlier about cruising and, like, the apps, I'm now at that age where I'm like, oh, you poor kids, you're missing out because you don't get to learn how to actually flirt with someone in person. You have to like do it with a keyboard. And so you're never going to have those skills. But actually, maybe they don't need those skills.
Or maybe they might be interested in learning those skills now. Like, I don't know, there could be like a fatigue with the apps. But no, I think you're right. I think Will's death added, I don't know, it intensified what already would have been a feeling of generations really kind of punctuating and like being sectioned off. I think that would have been the case either way, but I think him passing away when he did, and it was also like the start of a new decade and Toronto was starting to go through all of these huge changes around that time. Mm. So I think there are a lot of factors that just made it feel like, boom, this era is over, like definitively, you know?
And you missed out.
But now I think as I've gotten older and I've seen like eras come and go, I'm trying to resist being one of those people who like tells the young people that things are no fun anymore, you know? I never liked hearing that from older people. And I want to believe that things are still fun now. They just look different, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I think as well. I think there's just that temptation to be like, when I was doing this, it was better.
Well, there's that great like Fran Lebowitz quote where she's from one of her lectures where she's like, oh, people always ask me if New York was better in the 70s and 80s. And I say, like, yes, it was better in the 70s and 80s, but I was also younger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. I think if you're finding that things are less fun now, later...
Maybe you're the problem.
Just that you're not hearing about them.
Yeah. But there's also something really tempting about leaning into the cranky old man aesthetic.
Oh, of course.
And like, as soon as I read that GIFs are apparently not cool anymore and you shouldn't be sending them, I was like, that's it. I'm all in.
Oh, shit.
I'm like, I'm sending GIFs to everyone. Like, you are all getting GIFs.
Amazing. I've already been a GIF girl and now maybe it's my time to double down.
Okay. So then what was it? Help situate me in this bar. So you've built up the courage. This is your first night. You've walked in. It's the size of a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking?
I'm like looking around infatuated by like every person who's there. And I'm like, oh my God, like I want to get to know everyone here. And at the time I started going there, there was a new crop of drag performers who were starting their own nights. They had guested, they'd done that thing where they'd booked performances for other people's events, but they had started their own parties more recently. It was these two queens in particular, Judy Virago and Igby Lizard, whose drag vibe was very kind of John Waters-y, very irreverent in that great kind of pre-Drag Race way where you'd walk into the bar and they'd like say something horrible to you. And their performances were genius, but also like totally disgusting, involving like piss and like champagne enemas and stuff. And I was, at the time I was like starting to go to their parties. I was also in art school for illustration, but not really enjoying any of the assignments I was doing for school. And there were a couple of artists in Toronto who were illustrating poster gigs for queer parties. And when I saw those postered around town, I was like, oh, I want to do that someday. Like, that looks so fun. And kind of a way to bring my like comic book background into my nightlife obsession, you know? Because when I looked at these drag queens, I was like, oh, these are basically comic book characters come to life. Like, they're literally like drawing a face the way that I draw faces. So I think I literally, I got over my shyness and I think I just walked up to them one night, introduced myself and was like, could I draw a poster for you someday? And I think I offered my labor for free, which what drag performer could say no to that, you know? But I started doing posters for them on occasion and it was really fun. We struck this great dynamic where I would often just get paid in drink tickets or something. But in exchange, I had a lot of creative freedom to do what I wanted. And they were very encouraging, receptive towards like weird ideas. And they would, we'd often collaborate on the ideas too.
So I was going to ask about that. So if someone wanted to create a new night and they came to you and they said, Eric, need a poster, what questions would you ask of them in order to come up with your concept?
It was easier at first because it would be parties that I'd already gone to.
Okay.
So I already kind of knew what the vibe was. So I already had something to go off of. But
well, how about we do a little bit of role play where I'm the client and you're trying to like figure out what to do for my poster?
Oh my God, I guess I would ask like what kind of music is played, what's the crowd like, does the party have a theme?
The theme is sitting on cakes.
Uh-huh.
And we're listening to music from the 60s until the 70s, mostly folk music, but we have a drum and bass beat underneath it. And the people there like to wear cardigans.
Hot. Oh my God, this party sounds great. I think the first thing that comes to mind would be like, yeah, like literally having someone sitting on a cake, but then towards the bottom of the cake, you'd see the icing start like, the icing would have more of a vibrating quality to it to signify, I don't know, that there's like, ooh, like crazy drum and bass happening under the surface. Yeah, it's funny working with clients for party posters because sometimes I get carte blanche to do whatever, and then other times people come to me with the most specific directive, like I want this and this and this. And either approach is great, honestly. Sometimes it's hard coming up with ideas,
so
I'm happy when they have one.
But even when they have the idea, like what is your process in order to get the right, I'm going to say this word, vibe for the party? Like, how do you like at what point are you like, yeah, this encapsulates what this party is about? Because that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, and I kind of had, it was trial and error at first. The first poster I ever did for Judy and Igby was for their Drag Race viewing party. Mm-hmm. They were one of the first queens in town to do that. This was circa Drag Race, like season 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. And it was super, like, I feel very much like, hey, back in my day, this is how it happened. But they would literally, the episode would air on Monday. They would torrent the episode, play the episode in the bar on Tuesday, project it onto a bed sheet taped to the wall. And then some weeks, if they couldn't torrent the episode, they would just be like, well, oops, no episode this week, but come anyway, we'll be performing. But for the particular Drag Race viewing party, it was at the Hen House bar, and the Hen House wanted to use their viewing party to promote their kitchen. Like, they would have a dinner special. Mm. So they called it Dinner in a Drag Race. Mm. And I forget if it was my idea or Judy and Igby's idea, but they had me illustrate the two of them shitting and puking rainbows.
Mmm, I'm feeling hungry.
And when we brought it to the Hen House's management, the bar was like, I don't think this is the vibe for, like, we're trying to promote our food and this poster is giving, like, food poisoning energy. So that was a very kind of, like, formative experience, being like, oh, okay, there are, like, some practical considerations to keep in mind.
And were you heartbroken or did you not take that personally?
I understood. I more felt like an idiot. I was like, oh, like, that's, you're right. Like, I can't argue with that. But Judy and Igby were able to salvage it immediately, though, because the poster was finished and they were like, oh, well, we're actually starting our own new monthly party at the Beaver called Bad Tuck, and it's just gross out themes. Mm-hmm. So let's just use this illustration for that instead. And Bad Tuck became my first, like, regular postering job. And that party was really where I would think Judy and Igby were able to create their own community and their own scene at the Beaver. Mm-hmm. I felt that they were the first nightlife people to do something post-Will that was very much its own thing, mm-hmm. while still feeling like it was in the overall mm-hmm. lineage.
And so you've just said that they managed to create their own scene. Mm-hmm. Were you part of that scene?
Yeah, I think I was. They started a collective called the House of Filth that had all of their drag children in it, but it would also include the DJs they worked with and the artists they worked with. So they included me, like, I was kind of part of the house, but I did sometimes keep it at an arm's length because some of their parties got, like, too much for me. Like, compared to today's drag scene in Toronto, I miss some of the sharper, like, rougher edges of the Bad Tuck parties. Just, like, yeah, kind of a bit of a demonic energy, like, lots of drugs, lots of, like, getting really fucked up. But sometimes people would, like, act a fool a bit too much. There was this one performer friend of theirs who was, like, a hurricane, and she would show up and make everyone into their worst selves. And at one of their parties, this person pissed into a bunch of shot glasses and then brought them around to all the performers, being like, I got us tequila shots. So, you know, they're just occasionally I'd hear stuff happening and be like, okay, I'm leaving at 1 a.m. tonight. I'm not going to the after party, you know?
So you like it messy, but not too messy. Is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's always been my vibe. Like, I love me a good time, but there's this great meme of Gemma Collins sitting in a bar and there's a bar fight happening behind her and she's just sipping this big drink and she just looks at her phone and says, I'm not getting involved. I'm just over here doing me GC style. I just want to be me. And I've always felt that that's my vibe.
And just to, so I'm clear, was that your best Essex accent?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. All right. Well, we can practice
exit
later.
Exit chat. This podcast is over.
On behalf of the people of Essex.
I'll tweet out an apology after this. But yeah, I think that's the key to lasting in those scenes is to...
Tap out.
You will have to be involved, of course, and to
show your face and then bugger off.
More than that, I mean, like, I love to throw down and like have a good time, but I also like know when to exit.
So when you know it's time to exit, do you say goodbye or do you slink away into the night?
I'm notorious for slinking away into the night. Yeah. I think that's the best way. A French exit.
French? I thought it was an Irish exit.
It's both I've heard. I mean, is that right? I think it's either French exit or Irish goodbye or both. Ah. I've heard both.
Yeah. What is it about the French and the Irish that people have decided?
I'm just curious. I have French exit versus Irish goodbye. These are things I should know. Okay, yeah, it's the same, yeah.
But basically, you and I would be fine in France or Ireland, but in every other country in the world, people get annoyed.
Yeah, pretty much. But no, I mean, if I'm with like a solid core crew of people, I'll say bye to them.
Okay.
But I'm never going to be one of those people to like go around and like announce to everyone that I'm leaving. Like it's a bit main character vibes, you know, like no one cares.
Oh, well, I find it really difficult because I keep like going to say goodbye to people and they're like, oh, I haven't spoken to you this evening. And then I'm like, oh, does that mean you want to speak to me now? And then I like have a whole conversation with them. And then I go to the next person and it happens again and again and again.
That sounds horrible.
And then it's like an hour later and I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. And then I go back to the original person and they're like, oh, I thought you were leaving. And I was like, I was leaving. And then they're like, oh, well, I feel like we haven't talked properly. And then
I'm not
I just
doing
go
all
around
that,
the whole
you know?
Circle again. Yeah. So I just have to leave. I can't. I'm just no small talk for me. Sorry. Bye.
No. Yeah. And you know, if I'm at a rave thing, I'll say bye to the people I came with. To let them know that I'm like okay and to make sure they're okay and everything.
So you don't wait until you're at home in bed and then send them a text message saying, oh, I went home.
I do that sometimes.
You're only human.
Yeah.
So when did the beaver close?
I would say the beaver lasted longer than I thought it would. I'll say that. I think in the years leading up to lockdown, it was a little worse for wear. I feel like it wasn't getting a ton of love, like in terms of maintenance, which gave me this feeling that its days were numbered. I also knew its days were numbered because the whole block it's on is scheduled to become a condo, much like every other block in Toronto. Hilariously, though, the goss I heard was that the condo company purchased up this whole block, including the beaver, not realizing that this tiny laneway behind the bar is city property and can't be built on. So I think that's honestly what gave the beaver its extra years, was this weird kind of legal limbo. I'm sure the developer is eventually going to get around that, but... it was cute. Like I noticed as the years crept into like 2017, 2018, there were even like younger people starting their own drag nights who had been like inspired by the House of Filth, Bad Tuck Nights, and had their first bookings there. So I was happy to see it last long enough to see a new crop of people make it into what they wanted, much like me and mine were able to. But when everything closed for lockdown, I think we all had a feeling that the beaver like probably wouldn't open again. And they announced a few months into lockdown that it was closed for good. But I got to say this really meaningful little goodbye to the space because just a year before it closed, I was able to paint this big mural in the beaver. First, it was washroom graffiti turned into murals. And then after that, I asked the bar manager if there are any other walls I could paint on. And I think in the spirit of like, oh, this place is kind of going to shit anyway, let's do something nice. He was like, oh yeah, paint on whatever. Like, I don't care. So I painted this big mural on overlooking the dance floor with all of these queer icons, both local and broader. Like there's like Will Monroe iconography, but then there's also like Liza from Cabaret and like Pickle Surprise and whatnot, like all these characters. But while I was painting the mural, they had given me a key to the bar and they never asked for it back. So after the bar closed in lockdown times, me and a couple of friends were able to sneak in and kind of say our own goodbyes to it. There was this very sweet night in the summer of 2020 when I invited a bunch of Beaver people onto the back patio, and we each took turns one by one going inside, because at the time it was like, oh, you can't go inside. So we went in one by one and took like our final bathroom mirror selfies. Aww. And just like wandered the space. And I was very happy we were able to do that. It gave us this weird, this kind of sweet sense of closure.
Mm. So to finish us off, what did the Beaver teach you about yourself?
Oh, my God. Aw, this is so cheesy to say, but I think it taught me that I've, like, got the goods as I am, you know? It's somewhere where I felt that I could, like, bring what I have already, and that would be embraced and appreciated. Like, I don't know, it was really my second home for all of my 20s. In a way that it was for so many people. Yeah, I don't know. It felt like such an extension of myself. Like I lived 10 minutes away from it. Mm. They used to be open for lunch and I would go there and just have lunch and draw stuff until my restaurant shift in the evening. So I don't know. Yeah, it felt very like a queer Cheers vibe. Yeah, no, I think it taught me that I like didn't have to bend or contort myself too much to make it all work.
Do you have any memories of the Beaver or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, stop everything that you're doing right now and get in touch. Let me know all about it. I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I can't do it alone. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to. You could also reach out to me on Facebook and Instagram if you would prefer. My handle on both is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Eric by following him on Instagram at eric.k.w or visit his website kostiekwilliams.com. And his book 2AM Eternal is out now, so do make sure you go and grab a copy. You need this in your life, I promise. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, or just tell other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.